This is a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. 1 year ago today.
The foreign minister has just tweeted that the country is under full-scale invasion by Russia. He says peaceful cities are under attack.
We are marking 1 year since Russia invaded Ukraine, an invasion that Russian President Vladimir Putin justifies by arguing Ukraine belongs to his country. Ukrainians disagree.
He wants to believe that Ukraine is just part of Russia, but it is not. It has totally different nation, totally different country, totally different culture and history, and we're proud of it.
So proud that some Ukrainians stayed in their country despite the war, including Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Я скажу одне. Я залишаюсь тут, залишаюсь у Києві, не ховаючись, і нікого не боюсь.
Saying there, now I will say one thing. I remain here, I remain in Kyiv, I am not hiding, and I am not afraid of anyone. 365 days of war, of displacement, of uncertainty. While some stayed, others couldn't. Relocating to places like Massachusetts, they joined a diaspora here in the Commonwealth, more than 10,000 strong, living in two worlds at once.
So much is up in the air. So much is to be determined in terms of the next steps for them.
Months after relocating, those who left remain loyal to Ukraine, loyal to its values and its mission.
When you're free, you can do everything you want. You can change this world for better. But when you are not free, you just survive.
Sound there from Al Jazeera, the New York Times, and from our own coverage here on WBUR over the last year, including Ukrainians Olga Lizovska and Sofia Tarasuk, and Caroline Davis from Accentria, who's been resettling Ukrainian refugees in Massachusetts, all of whom we will hear from today. So 365 days, the war still continues. What comes next for Ukraine and its people? Well, let's begin with Congressman Jake Auchincloss, who represents the state's 4th Congressional District. He's also a Marine Corps veteran. Congressman, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
It's great to have you back. Thank you. And I just want to start, Congressman, by asking you what's on your mind today as we mark a year.
The example of the Ukrainian people fighting for freedom for a year now in conditions that beggar belief, and a complete commitment as the voice and vote of the people of Massachusetts to continue to support the people of Ukraine for as long as it takes, with whatever it takes, all the way through Crimea.
You said the phrase beggar belief, and that really caught me. The conditions that beggar belief, because you've served in theater, you know what the conditions of war look like. What does beggar belief about what we've seen, Congressman?
I served in theater with a platoon of well-trained, well-equipped Marines at my back. The Russians are terrorizing children. They're raping women. They're torturing men. They are committing war crimes at scale, and they are targeting civilian infrastructure intentionally to sow a demoralizing and paralyzing terror in the population, but it's not working. The Ukrainian people have a heart of a lion. And so I think we as Americans need to have the Ukrainians back for three reasons. One, it's the right thing to do. The Ukrainians are fighting on the front lines of the free world, and they need our help. And we as Americans got help of our own when we were fighting for our independence 250 years ago. Second, it's the smart thing to do. We've spent $110 billion, roughly about 12% of an annual defense budget in support of Ukraine. And for that, look at what we've gotten in return. We're on track to double NATO's border and deepen its unity. We have induced Germany and Japan and South Korea and the Eastern European states to increase their domestic defense spending, and we've cratered Russia's conventional military capacity. It's been a huge return on investment in terms of national security dollars spent. And third, it's the American thing to do. This is about supporting the rules-based international order that America helped architect after World War II and that has helped peace and prosperity spread to ever more people. And it's a fragile order that must be upheld at times with strength.
So we're speaking with Congressman Jake Auchincloss on the line. And I, you know, you said right thing to do, smart thing to do, American thing to do. And in that smart thing to do, you talked about the roughly $110 billion. We invited members of our texting group to send comments and thoughts and questions today. And if you're not a member of that group and want to join, you send the word Boston to 617-766-0382. Congressman, there were a number of people beginning to express concern and fatigue about the level of American commitment. One example, Yolette of Randolph. I can't believe that Russia continues with their war. I have a lot of respect for the Ukrainian people and government. I'm sad about all the lost lives and suffering. However, I think that the Biden administration has given them a lot of money. There's so much need here in this country that's not being addressed. I think too much has been sent to Ukraine. It has to stop. The Ukrainian president may need to sit down with Putin and negotiate a way to stop the war. Not uncharacteristic, some of the other comments that we got as well. First, you know, your response to that, and is there a threshold where it's too much?
We certainly haven't reached it. I hear the concern. Let me address it on a couple of fronts. One, as I said, this is actually the highest return on national security dollars of the 21st century. I mean, you look at what we did in Afghanistan and Iraq, the trillions of dollars spent and the marginal returns at best. And here, for really about a tenth of our annual defense spending, we have significantly expanded the military capabilities of the West and our East Asian allies in regards and in proportion to the Russians' conventional military capacity. This has been a huge, huge rebalancing of military power towards NATO. Yes, there's need here in the United States, and we are addressing it. The funding of the last 2 years through infrastructure, science, domestic manufacturing, expanded and strengthened social safety nets. There are real costs to a fraying and an undermining of the rules-based international order. It sounds abstract. It sounds like a nebulous concept, but indeed it has been one of the key tenets of a huge expanse of the standards of living of so many people in the world over the last 70 years. And when we allow might to make right, when America turns its back on supporting freedom and democracy, we don't know where that thread ends up getting pulled to. But at this point, Ukraine can't sit down with Vladimir Putin. He's made very clear that he has a revanchist, blood and soil mission to devour Ukraine whole. And only the battlefield and facts on the ground can change his mind.
Jake Auchincloss, Congressman here in Massachusetts, I'm going to ask you to stay on the line. I'm going to bring a second voice in now, Olga Lisovska, who's a Ukrainian singer, an immigrant who came to the United States in the 1990s, now lives in Newton, Massachusetts, making her one of your constituents, Congressman. Olga, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
I want to note you've been sitting here in Studio 2 with me, and I think it's been hard to sit and listen to some of this for you.
Absolutely. It's a flashback to about a week before the war started. I was in the office with Jake Auchincloss, and I remember him saying when he was fresh out of the debriefing with the White House, and we asked him as a group of Ukrainian immigrants here, diaspora, asking, so what are the news? And I remember, Mr. Auchincloss, you said, not good. And I remember just this feeling of, you know, the sixth sense washing over me that something's not going to happen. So that's when I tried to talk my friends and family into, you know, taking a trip out of Ukraine just in case something's going to start. But nobody believed back then. And so 1 year later, and it's been just a year, but it feels like a century. Nothing is the same.
We talked to you right around that time. Did your family ever leave, or are they all still there?
So my brother is still there. All of my cousins and aunts are still there. My mom had a very adventurous and arduous journey. About a couple of weeks after the war started, she took a really difficult trip from Kiev by train to Lviv, from Lviv to Budapest, and actually was on the, while I was doing an interview with Jan Adams of New TV, I asked her, do you know anybody in Budapest? And she said, actually, as a matter of fact, I do. And somebody was right there to help her when she was passing through Budapest.
This is Newton Community Television. So this is just basically exactly. In your neighborhood.
Exactly.
So let's bring Congressman, jump back in. You hear Olga reflecting there on a moment with you that led to that phone call. Maybe it's time for a visit. Do you remember that time?
Oh, I remember it well. I'm reminiscing of that meeting in my Newton district office with Olga and a number of other members of the Ukrainian diaspora. And Olga, I remember I asked the group, and I said, will they fight? Because the war was coming. And I'll never forget, the response was three words, they will fight. And it has been proven true 1,000 times over.
How does it feel, Olga, a year later, 365 days later, to see, witness, talk back home to the fierce fighting on the ground that really has, I think, arguably defied what seems to be pretty much everyone's expectations except the expectations of the people of Ukraine?
Yes, I was actually surprised that the Americans would think that Ukrainians would not be defending their freedom, because it's just in our blood. We are such a proud nation. We are a peaceful nation. We love culture. We love education. That's where our main focus is. We're not imperialistic in nature. However, if you touch us, if you try to take our freedom away, you'd better, you will be sorry. So, a year later, I'm not surprised. This is exactly what I envisioned in terms of the resilience and the fight back from the Ukrainian people. However, I have to say that if it were not for the friends of Ukraine, especially the United States and the allies, this would not be possible.
So I'd like to stay with this idea. We're speaking with Olga Lazovska, who's a local Ukrainian singer, lives in Newton, Jake Auchincloss, Massachusetts congressman, of these American friends. And I want to do it on two levels. So Olga, I'm going to do the local level with you first. And then Congressman, I'm going to do the more meta level with you second. We have a strong local diaspora. Your community of Newton is a part of that. What has that response been like over the last year? And what's the most necessary thing to support the local diaspora today?
So I would say that diaspora has always been very proud of Ukrainian heritage. However, in the face of adversity, we came back stronger than ever together. We're so united, and we even had our first big Ukrainian festival that was held on the grounds of Boston University. It was in August. Over 3,000 people came, and it was just amazing to see all the support, people crying together, just strangers coming and hugging each other and sharing their stories, and people coming up to me even in the gym yesterday and saying, how can I get through to the American politicians about sending more arms to Ukraine. So it's the Ukrainian community and just the local community of Americans of all different nationalities. They're there to support Ukraine. And what's needed is that we need to listen more to our diaspora, and would love to have another conversation with you, Mr. Auchincloss.
So Congressman, let me let you jump in there.
Well, my door is always open. I'm not the one we need to convince, though. I'm all in and will remain so because I know the importance, both moral and strategic. And although there is some fraying at the edges of bipartisan support for further aid to Ukraine, I want to reiterate that it remains robust. It is strong in both parties. And I do expect that we can pass another aid package this year. Yes, the hard right is increasingly vocal, but they remain a minority even within their own conference. And I do think Republican leadership is going to be able to rally votes to make it a still a strong bipartisan consensus.
So, Congressman, I'm glad you brought us to that level because that's where I want to go next. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you two other submissions from people in our texting group. And I'll give you the question out of there. The first is from Joyce of East Falmouth. Joyce says, I truly believe if we don't help Ukraine, the world as we know it is over. Nothing will stop Putin. My heart is with the people there who are showing incredible strength and fortitude. And I'll stop there with that one. And then Leo of Cambridge. I applaud Congressman Auchincloss on his support of Taiwan in its existential struggle with communist China. How can America ensure that Taiwan doesn't become the next Ukraine? And what can Americans at home do to support these efforts? Now, we're talking about Ukraine today, but you just came back from Taiwan. My understanding is you got back sometime yesterday from this diplomatic mission. And this is happening in a larger context of a, I don't know if it's Cold War or not, but a lot of tension with China, who may be lining up on the other side here. What's the strategic imperative right now with Olga sitting in front of me, right, who's thinking about family and friends in country in Ukraine as we go forward under the brutal conditions you referred to?
I don't want to overextend the comparisons between Russia and China because they are vastly different countries and each need their own strategies. But both Putin and Xi Jinping are autocrats, and fundamentally they respect only strength. And people had better believe that Xi Jinping is watching on an hourly basis what happens with NATO's resolve in Ukraine, because it does affect his cost-benefit analysis on Taiwan. This is about demonstrating that we are willing to fight and uphold the liberal order. And so far, I think the depth of resolve has been impressive in the last year. However, the breadth, the width of that resolve has to me been disappointing. And what I mean by that is countries like India, Brazil, South Africa, Indonesia, major economies that could have been hugely important in the sanctions regime against Russia, in their diplomatic voice, have been either neutral or, in fact, actively sympathetic with Russia. And this needs to be a gut check for the United States. We need to do much more in our economic alliances with the global South to get them bought into this rules-based order, to let them see, to make them feel why it's so valuable to uphold, because clearly right now, they're not. And that's going to be absolutely critical vis-a-vis China and Taiwan. We need to take the Indo-Pacific economic framework, which encompasses everybody from Australia through India and Southeast Asia and East Asia, and knit those multilateral alliances closer together, not at the level of NATO, because that has been unique, but with deeper security and economic ties for sure, because America's strength in the next 10 years largely is going to be manifested through our alliances. This world is multipolar. We cannot act alone. We need to act with our friends, even though we're going to remain the largest power.
So I want to pick up that thread. And Olga Lisowska, I'll turn back to you. President Biden in Warsaw a few days ago, before the show, you and I were talking in the hall. You were sort of expressing wonder at his ability to just sort of pop up in Kyiv. Then he goes to Warsaw. Here's some sound from a speech that he made in Warsaw after the visit.
1 year ago, the world was bracing for the fall of Kyiv. Well, I just come from a visit to Kyiv, and I can report Kyiv stands strong. Kyiv stands proud. It stands tall. And most important, it stands free.
And I wanted to play that for this word free. And we heard Sofia Tarasuk at the top, who we're going to hear more from later in the show, talk about what you have or don't have when you have freedom. And we've just heard your congressman, Jake Auchincloss, talk about sort of this larger strategic imperative around a rules-based order that is, you know, rooted in the concepts of democracy and freedom. One, do you believe your country will stay free? And two, does it give you comfort to know that that battle is located in a larger struggle? Or is it frustrating to have a conflict that's so personal to you situated in a larger struggle?
Absolutely. I believe that Ukraine will be free. There is nothing that is going to come in the way of total victory for Ukraine. Everybody is supporting Ukraine, the Ukrainians, that's their goal and that's their mission in life. And if you stand for freedom, then you stand for Ukraine. And Ukraine in the last year has become synonymous with the fight for freedom, with resilience. And of course, listening to Jake Auchincloss talk about the larger structure of this whole
which I asked him
alliance.
To do.
Yes. It is, of course, very frustrating because you don't want your country to be in the middle of political struggles of bigger powers. But I don't think that's the case here. I think that's what Putin wants people to think, that Ukraine is just being used as a pawn by the United States, but it's definitely not what Ukrainians believe. We have an expression that true friends are, you recognize true friends when the adversity comes. And definitely this war has shown who our friends and who our enemies are. And we used to think of Russians as our neighbors and friends and even brothers. Well, that's changed now. They're no longer our brothers and definitely not very good neighbors. But the United States has shown that they are here for us in the time of need.
Congressman, last thought from you about sort of what's most important in the next couple of months in your role and your position.
Ukraine is likely to mount a counteroffensive in the spring, and I think the outcome of that counteroffensive cannot be overstated for how critical it is. We need to support Ukraine getting all the way to the sea and being able to cut off Russia's access to Crimea as the end of the beginning, I guess I would say, so that we can move on to a stage where Ukraine can start to actually retake Crimea and the Donbass. I think this counteroffensive and its success is pivotal.
That is Massachusetts Congressman Jake Auchincloss. Congressman, I appreciate you joining us fresh off that trip to Taiwan. I'm going to say goodbye to you there. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
So now, Olga, as we finish this conversation, we're going to do it a little bit differently because you're going to sing for us a minute. But to do so, I want to play a bit of an NPR reporter, Joanna Kakissis, on Morning Edition this morning.
Just think about how different this city was a year ago. It was so vibrant and full of life. And now many residents of the city are dead. Many others are refugees. Others are on the front line fighting.
And that fighting is what's on my mind because you chose, you're going to sing us out to the end of the segment today. I'm going to say goodbye to you and then you're going to sing. You wanted to sing a song called How Can I Not Love You, My Kyiv, which you tell us is considered the anthem of Kyiv. Is that right?
That's correct.
And why did you want to sing that today?
Well, it's my home city. I have the most wonderful memories. My family is still there. And this song is about how beautiful it is and how peaceful it is. And I want this to be a prophetic song that very soon we'll see Kyiv come back to its beautiful self.
So we'll close with that. Olga Lisovska here in Studio 2 singing for us, How Can I Not Love You, My Kyiv. Olga, thank you.
Грає море зелене, тихий день добра. Дорогими для мене стали схили Дніпра, де колишуться віти закоханих мрій. Як тебе не любити, Києве мій? Спить натомлене місто тихим лагідним сном. Ген вогні, як намисто, розцвіли над Дніпром. Вечорів оксамити, мов щастя прибій. Як тебе не любити, Києве мій? Вечорів оксамити, мов щастя прибій. Як тебе не любити,
On February 24th, 2022, Sofia Tarasuk was in her pajamas in her dorm room in Kyiv when everything changed.
I heard knocking in the door in my room, and my neighbor said the war started and we need to go to the bomb shelter.
Tarasuk and her friends traveled to Lviv to that shelter, but even as they didn't fully believe what was happening to them.
We thought that that was a joke because it's hard to understand that in 21st century we can help war.
Tarasuk would soon flee Ukraine, traveling first to Lithuania and then landing as a student at Brandeis University. We spoke with her last fall as she was adapting to a new life and new plans.
My plan was to stay in Ukraine, in my country, to get a master's degree in my country. I had a job. Everything was so wonderful. I had a lot of plans, a lot of friends, plans to travel in other countries. But, you know, everything changed in one moment.
We checked back in with Sofia Tarasuk earlier this week to find out how she's doing. And so that was the first thing I asked. How is she?
I can't even believe that it's already my 5th month here, and time is going very fast. Now I already know a lot about American lifestyle, and I know a lot about how to live and to be American girl. But still, I always in my thoughts in Ukraine with my family, with my friends, and sometimes it looks like I live two different lives, just in Ukraine, in my thoughts, but physically here in U.S.
Sofia, what's one thing that's different, to use your words, from being an American girl and being a Ukrainian girl?
Talking about my experience and last year, I can definitely say that here in U.S., I can be in a safe environment, not to worry about bombing or other things which can be dangerous for my life. But being in Ukraine, it's always about courage and thinking about helping other people.
The last time we talked with you, we talked about your family, your parents. You have a brother who is of fighting age there. How is everyone now?
So my family live on west of Ukraine. There is no active attacks there, but my family still feels that they live in war conditions. My parents are teachers, and they are trying to provide education for children in my city. Sometimes they tell me a story about the lessons in bomb shelters. So also my parents created their own organization, and they help people who lost their houses and who live now in my native city. So they provide them with food, money, clothes, and other things. I even couldn't believe and imagine that my parents would do it once, but now they do it, and I'm so proud of them.
You sound like I would expect a kid to sound, right? Both proud of their parents and also mildly surprised that their parents had it in them to do it.
Yes, yes, you're right.
Have you told your parents that?
I told them it directly, but I think they feel that I'm really proud of them. And we talk actually every day for several reasons, just to know that everything is fine. And also, it's a connection which helps me to be here without them and helps them to be strong and to continue to live and fight in Ukraine.
You know, it strikes me in speaking with you, and we already know you're a resilient young person because of the journey you created for yourself from that moment you woke up in your pajamas, right, on the day the bombing started, February 24th, 2022, to today. So we know you're resilient, but you sound happy. You sound full. You sound okay. What has gotten you from there to here, Sofia?
I think that it is the inspiration of Ukrainians. People in Ukraine, they continue to fight. They continue to be brave. And every time when I read stories of Ukrainians, when I see news terrible or sometimes good news, when I see Ukrainians here in US, it gives me a lot of power also to continue to live and to help Ukrainians here in US.
How are you doing that?
It's very powerful for me to meet with Ukrainians, and we have here Ukrainian community, and sometimes we have some events. I try to join that events, but also This month, I'm working on creating an exhibition in my university. This exhibition will unite a lot of people around the world, because a lot of students around the world who are generally from Ukraine, they decided to create one exhibition about students who died because of the war in Ukraine. And we called this exhibition Unissued Diplomas, just to dedicate this exhibition to students who lost their lives and can't continue studying, enjoying the student life. And in my university, I'm trying to organize everything and implement this exhibition too. And it's a big responsibility for me, because it's a story of 36 students. Each of them is special. Each of them is crucial. Each of them could have continued for decades, but very cruelly interrupted by Russians. And now each story should be remembered by the rest of the world. For me, it's very responsible just to talk about it, just to remember again and again that the war is still going, and we need to do as much as we can just to stop it and just continue to live in peaceful conditions.
So I want to backtrack a little more about the kids that you're remembering, honoring, and calling. I looked at the diplomas. We're talking about kids who are 17, 18, 19, 20, who died over the last year since the beginning of the Russian invasion into Ukraine. And you talked about the responsibility of helping bring this exhibit forward. I wonder if you feel a responsibility to live and thrive as you steward these kids who didn't into our collective psyche.
Yes, I feel this responsibility, and I have so a lot of opportunities, and I feel that, okay, now I can study, I can see, and I can gain new experience here. And one day I want to return in my country and bring everything which I will gain here to my country and to continue to develop my country. Because some people already paid big price for our freedom and for the future of next generation in Ukraine.
When do you think you'll be able to go back?
I wish to do it after graduating, so in 1 year already. But I don't know. When the war will finish, I would like to return.
Do you think about the war in terms of winning and losing? Like, do you feel your country's winning or losing? Do you even think about it that way?
It's a very complicated question, actually, and I can't answer it because I'm not so professional from the side of army side. But I can say that we all still have a lot of strengths, and we will do as much as we can to win. And it doesn't matter how many time we need for that. 1 year, 2 years, I don't want to make it longer, but I can't influence on it.
How do you think you'll be different as a woman in the world having had this experience?
So I think that this war changed a lot of people, not only Ukrainians, but a lot of people around the world. And I think that especially Ukrainians understood their main strength. It's our ability to stay resilient, and it doesn't matter in which conditions. So I think it will also influence on my future too, because now I know that if you have your values, you don't have to change them, even if sometimes it can cost your life.
And what would you say today are your core values?
My core value is freedom, because when you're free, you can do everything you want. You can change this world for better. But when you are not free, you just survive.
That was Sofia Tarasuk, a Ukrainian student studying at Brandeis University. We're continuing our reflection now on 1 year since the start of Russia's war in Ukraine. Our conversation with graduate student Sofia Tarasuk challenges the rest of us to imagine, what if you had to leave home, really leave home, at a moment's notice. Over the last year, more than 115,000 Ukrainians have arrived in the U.S. through a special sponsorship program set up by the Biden administration. Hundreds of those have settled here in the Commonwealth, mainly in Greater Boston and in the Springfield area. But with the situation ongoing in Ukraine, the future in the U.S. remains uncertain. We welcome now three people who have been working directly with Ukrainians resettling in Massachusetts. First, Caroline Davis, Program Manager for Services for New Americans at Accentria Care Alliance. Marwa Alnal, Director of Government Affairs, also at Accentria Care Alliance. And Elizabeth Sweet, who is the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition, also known as MIRA. Caroline, welcome back.
Good morning.
Marwa, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth, good to have you again, too.
Wonderful to be here.
So, you know, the three of you represent kind of what is the full body of challenge for people coming to the U.S. from Ukraine, right? So you've got the legal dimension of status and work. You've got the day-to-day dimensions of life and where to live and what to eat and how to function. And we've got the context of resettlement, which is fast moving and big, with people coming from a lot of different places to the Commonwealth, and it through no fault of their own taxing our systems now. And we want to kind of get into that whole picture. Caroline, I'm going to start with you. Really basic. How many Ukrainians and families have you helped resettle through Accentria here in the Commonwealth?
So in the past year, we have worked with and are currently serving 340 Ukrainians. So these are individuals who have walked through our agency doors seeking services. They are not coming through our official refugee program. So in addition to those 340, we've also placed 41 direct refugees from Ukraine since March of last year.
So, Caroline, I'm glad actually that you said, you know, through the official program, not through the official program, because Elizabeth Sweet of MIRA, that's a piece of what I think we need to understand. What does that mean? An official refugee program, not official, et cetera?
It's a great question. So the refugee resettlement system in this country is quite complex, and it involves often a lengthy process of significant numbers of governmental security checks and other checks before approving someone to actually enter the United States. And so that program typically can take sometimes up to two or many more years to fully vet and approve an individual to be admitted as a refugee. And that includes making a determination, a legal determination, that the individual or the family actually qualify for refugee status. However, there have always been other legal ways to come to the United States, including our asylum system, which allows individuals to appear at ports and say that they also need protection because of fleeing from the same kinds of persecution as refugees.
So, Marwa, you're here in Studio 2 with me, and you were nodding as Elizabeth was speaking, kind of with this yup kind of look on your face. So let me just let you pick it up from there.
Well, I think Elizabeth, Liz, as we call her, but She hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's a really bureaucratic system, and people think that it's a very easy, your average American may think that it's a very easy process just to come to the United States. And in fact, it is a very difficult, strenuous process that takes a lot of time, that also is costly. It's not a cheap process for individuals coming to the United States either, in terms of filing for paperwork or having the proper documentation.
So you mean costly for the individuals or families?
Absolutely, because they have to have, you know, certain documentation. If you don't have that, you know, if you have to get it from your home country or place of birth, that also can be very costly. And it can also be very dangerous if you don't have access to that. So there are a lot of, different road stops and different, pits that you have to hit to get to the United States if you're going down, the typical, I say this with air quotes, typical refugee route that could take up to, 2 years plus in some cases.
So we have this other route that people are coming in. Caroline, I want to turn back to you now. I think, okay, so anybody who's ever had a nightmare customer service experience on a telephone knows how quickly it can break you. Now we're talking about people who are leaving home under incredibly stressful, terrifying conditions, finding themselves in a bureaucracy as they try to settle. How do we care for people as they arrive as a community here? What do we do? What do you do? What must we do with that compassion and understanding in mind?
That's a great question. And as we've recently faced three humanitarian crises in the past 3 years, or two years, so starting with the Afghan wave and then transitioning into the Ukrainian humanitarian crisis, as well as the Haitian, accessing members of our community to help bolster up all of these communities and support them and offer resources, anything from donations to housing support and volunteers getting connected with our families. Our ultimate goal is to really connect all of our families with a volunteer or a circle of care.
What does the volunteer do, Caroline? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm intrigued by that.
It's a great question. So we have different roles and designations for our volunteers. They could work as a family support individual who's going and visiting the home and trying to determine what's needed for that family. Because large families, small families, single individuals all come with various sets of needs, whether or not they learn English. It might be one-on-one tutoring or helping a mother, a single mother, get her children enrolled in school and navigate the local public systems. There are kind of longer-term volunteers who connect our adults to employment opportunities and to higher education and act as a mentor as they make their way through society. So there's anything starting off at a basic level to kind of the longer term family support. And it's a friend. It's a friend that our new refugees, our new immigrants can have and be guided by. And it's not just plowing through the system of getting our clients connected to resources, which I think can be very easily overshadowed.
We're speaking with Caroline Davis and Marwa Alnahl of Acentria Care Alliance on Elizabeth Sweet of the Mira Coalition as we do this special hour on Radio Boston, looking at our Ukrainian community here in Massachusetts, where we are 365 days after the beginning of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and kind of the moment that we're in. And Elizabeth Sweet, I'm going to turn back to you at Mira. What do we do well here? And what should we do better than we do when it comes to helping people? Asylum, refugee, we'll set that distinction aside for a minute when it comes to helping people reestablish themselves here in the Commonwealth.
So there's a number of different levels to answer that question. And I think first, it's so important to acknowledge the incredible organizations on the ground, such as the Acentria Care Alliance and so many other local organizations that are providing these critical services. That is such a key piece of making this entire system work. That, as they've described, that depends on volunteers, it depends on so many individuals to make this successful for everyone. Here in Massachusetts, we also want to acknowledge that the state also stepped up to assist Ukrainian refugees. In April of 2022, state lawmakers did pass $10 million in funding to help the state's Office of Refugees and Immigrants prepare for increased refugee arrivals. So that's been a really important piece of us welcoming individuals here in Massachusetts.
So, Marwa, I'll turn to you now. So, Elizabeth just talks about the way that the state stepped up. April of 2022, the state steps up an extra $10 million. The Biden administration creates a special sponsorship program for people leaving Ukraine. From the beginning, we have thought about this not only in context of solidarity and alliance with Ukrainians who need to seek refuge here, but also in the context of the compare and contrast with Haitian immigrants, Central and South American immigrants, Syrian immigrants, those fleeing Afghanistan after the United States left the country. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to, even in this moment where we are, you know, thinking clearly and fully about what Ukrainians on the ground there are experiencing, we have to keep that context. And I'm inviting a compare and contrast from you.
I mean, absolutely. Unfortunately, we have seen a difference in sort of treatment, for example, between the Ukrainian or even Afghan and our Haitian migrants as well. So that was a huge, huge problem of concern, even for resettlement agencies and for MIRA. These are constant, you know, Liz can attest to the constant conversations that we had, that we cannot forget people behind. So we, even within the $10 million that were passed, that was passed last April, in the beginning, state legislators only included the term Ukrainian. But we went back and we said Ukrainian and others. We are not going to single-handedly just serve one community. We as resettlement agencies are obligated to serve all. So this concept of equity and equality and serving everyone equally and fighting for everyone in an equitable manner is certainly one of the top, levels of concerns for every resettlement agency and every individual that works within the field of resettlement. And I think we constantly strive for that, you know, equitable, you know, opportunity or field that we can reach. But there are hurdles and there are concerns, you know, whether they're on purpose or whether it's just, you know, unconscious. I don't want to say it's not of our concern, but it really isn't, because it's 2023 and we are here to help people, you know, and everyone in this field, and I always mention this everywhere I go, they're doing it because they love what they do and because they care about these people and they care about others. And that's really hard to do, given everything going on in the world, to also, you know, put yourself aside for a second and think about the struggles of others. So, you know, I commend my colleagues and, you know, whether at Accenture or at the other resettlement agencies and at, you know, organizations like MIRA for doing this.
So, Caroline, I'll turn back to you. You're also at Accenture. If someone wants to help right now, wants to volunteer, wants to get involved, wants to step up, as Marwa was just talking about, what can they do and where can they go? Oh, we lost Caroline. Marwa, she's your colleague. Can you answer the question for her? We lost her.
Absolutely. Certainly reach out to Accenture.org. You can go right directly onto our website. We have a bunch of resources out there. You can connect with Accenture staff. You can submit forms. I think the neighborhood support teams, I don't know if they're still going on or if they're kind of put a pause at the moment. Since I don't directly work on that, I don't have an answer to that. But certainly, you know, Accenture.org. We'll have all the resources that should be needed as well.
And Elizabeth Sweet, in our last 30 seconds or so, the call to action. We're at the end of a painful year. Mm-hmm. The forward's uncertain. What's the call to action, Elizabeth?
So I think there are two key calls to action here.
Just briefly.
One is to, continue to ensure that all refugees and all asylum seekers have equal pathways to the protection that they need and deserve. And I also want to very briefly add that in addition to the ability to sponsor Ukrainian refugees, there are now programs to sponsor refugees from other countries, including Haiti, Venezuela, and others. And we hope to see the same kind of public support that we've seen for the Ukrainians.
Elizabeth Sweet, Executive Director of the MIRA Coalition, with the call to action there. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Marwa Alnahl, Director of Government Affairs at Accenture Care Alliance. Thanks so much to you, too.
Thank you.
And we had Caroline Davis with us, Program Manager for Services for New Americans from Accenture. And I want to thank Caroline from afar as well. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR 90.9 FM. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thank you for joining us. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.